You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Since the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, we've heard occasional reports of civilian casualties, the collateral damage of airstrikes. But it turns out that these days, ordinary Afghans are more afraid of who may come through their front door than from what may fall out of the sky. Afghans are regularly being pulled from their homes in the dead of night by U.S. forces and held for days or months without an opportunity to inform their families of what has happened. Anand Gopal, a journalist based in Kabul, explores these night raids and other topics in his article, America's Secret Afghan Prisons, in the February 15th issue of The Nation. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi, Anand.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What occurs during these night raids?
Well, these are raids often done by U.S. Special Forces, where they come in the middle of the night and they're looking for suspects. This is part of the counterterrorism effort. So usually these are people that are connected or whom they think are connected to the insurgency. They'll come to the house and take the suspects away and send them off to a series of prisons around the country. And this is something that Afghan families, have really been upset about, because often the family members will be taken away and they won't know where they've gone to, and they'll have no way of communicating with them.
And where are they happening? Is this happening in the big cities like Kabul, or are we mostly talking about rural areas?
This is all in the rural countryside, and it's one of the reasons why it's not as widely known. And it's happening in the ones and twos, meaning it's happening in a lot of small villages where one or two people are taken at a time. And this is very different from the airstrikes or the air raids that some of us may have heard of, which can kill up to 50 or 60 people and are much louder in that sense.
And why are they going after people at night? How does that fit into the larger counterterrorism strategy?
I think the special operations forces like to operate under the cover of night for security, for their own security, and they usually come in with night vision goggles and find the suspects unaware, usually at night, whereas they worry that if they come in the daytime, if there is a suspect who is armed or connected to the insurgency, then they'll be more ready to meet them with violent force.
Have these raids been taking place since the beginning of the war, or is this something more recent? Because we've been hearing more stories recently in the news.
I think we've been hearing more stories just because there's more attention being focused on Afghanistan in the last year or so. But really, this has been going on since the beginning, since 2001. And since it's usually special operations forces, it's something that's been happening separate from the conventional military structure that's there. But from the beginning of the U.S. invasion, there's been cases of these sorts of raids going on.
And then there was the recent story of the 8 children who were taken from their homes and executed in Kunar province.
That's right, and that's a typical example of this. In that case, the locals accused the special forces of coming in at night and taking the children outside of their homes and shooting them.
Is that likely? What would be gained by killing children?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to get at the bottom of a lot of this, because a lot of this is happening, as I mentioned, in the countryside. Really, it's really difficult to get out there and actually report and see some of these things. But what U.S. military officials would say is that a lot of children under the age of 18, but we're saying 15, 16, are members of the insurgency. People grow up very quickly in Afghanistan, and so you see. It's very common to see teenagers who have weapons, who fight against the U.S. forces, or who are members of the insurgency.
Is this something that people all throughout Afghanistan know? Is it being covered in the newspapers in the big cities?
You know, this is what was surprising to me, is when I went around the country trying to gather stories of civilian casualties from both sides. And I was expecting to hear a lot about airstrikes or even hear a lot about Taliban brutality. But I heard again and again throughout the country stories of these night raids. And so for the Afghans on the ground, this is very much part of their daily reality. And it's very well known. It's covered to an extent with the local press. But again, the difficulty here is that so much of this is happening outside of the cities where certainly where the Western media is based, and even where most of the Afghan media is based. It's happening in the really inaccessible reaches of the countryside, and it's really difficult to get those stories out.
What part of the military campaign is winning hearts and minds? What effect has these raids had on the Afghan public's attitude toward the war and the U.S. military presence?
Well, it's interesting because the very goal of the U.S. military presence is to protect the civilian population. And a lot of the civilians, especially in the countryside that I spoke to, said, yes, we want to be protected, but we want to be protected from these night raids and be protected from the Taliban. So in that regard, it's actually undermining the very thing that we're trying to do over there, which is win the hearts and minds.
So is it radicalizing Afghans?
It is. There's more than one case I interviewed for the story. I interviewed more than two dozen former detainees and even more family members. And a lot of them told me that after one of their family members were taken in one of these raids, that other family members went and joined the insurgency. I think it's one of the things that's pushed people away from the government and from the coalition forces. Even if they're not joining the insurgency or picking up a gun themselves, it does create a sort of sympathy for the insurgency and allows the insurgents to operate in areas where they couldn't before.
Has President Hamid Karzai been protesting this sort of thing?
He has. I believe just 2 days ago he had made another very forceful statement saying that coalition forces need to stop night raids and need to stop arbitrary detentions. And it's been a sore point between the Afghan government and the Western powers because it actually gets to the very question of who ultimately has the sovereignty to carry out these actions. And the Afghan government says that, and according to the Afghan constitution, only Afghan authorities are allowed to detain people. And clearly this is not happening, but there's been no way to resolve that between the two sides.
My guest is Anand Gopal, whose article, America's Secret Afghan Prisons, is in the current issue of The Nation. Is collateral damage the main sticking point here? In your article, you talk about a raid that happened this past November that resulted in two arrests and the death of two bystanders. First of all, why do bystanders have to die in the arrests of people? Were they complicit in the with the group that was being arrested?
Well, in this particular case, soldiers had entered the house late at night, and they entered the house by usually dynamiting the front door and so bursting in. Now, of course, when this happens, if you can imagine somebody dynamites your front door, you'll think you're under attack or you'll think that there's burglars or something coming into the house. And so this is what happened. So two of the family members got up and ran towards the door. And when they ran towards the door, the soldiers saw this as a threat, and so they shot both of them and killed them. And then they went on and searched the rest of the house. And this is very often what happens. There's many cases where people will think that they're under attack, even some cases where people will pick up their gun and think that they're being besieged by thieves and will run out with a gun and be shot. And so this is one of the main sticking points, which is not just that people are being taken away, but that civilians are being killed in the process.
And in this case, they were going after a man named Habib Rahman. And he has connected, his family has ties to the government, doesn't it?
Yeah, his cousin is actually the spokesman for the agriculture minister, and he himself works for the government. It's something I found a few times, that some of the people that are being detained are actually connected to the Afghan government. And it's quite frustrating for them because they try to use all of their government connections to try to get their loved ones out, but it usually doesn't work. And it's something in Afghanistan, the society which is run on these sorts of informal connections and networks, and when they don't work, it really brings a lot of angst to the people in question.
Well, his cousin made the point that the United States knew where Habib Rahman worked and could have come with a warrant in the daytime.
They don't come in the daytime. And you hear again and again from people who have been associated with these raids is that, well, it's one thing that people are being taken, but it's another thing is how they're being taken. And perhaps you can come with the Afghan security forces who have a better cultural understanding of the situation. One thing I didn't mention in the story, but which is a big sticking point for a lot of Afghans, is that Afghanistan is a very conservative society. The women tend to stay inside the home, and when foreign men enter the house and see the women, that's a big cultural affront. And so they've been asking for Afghan police and Afghan army to lead these searches. And the U.S. military authorities have agreed in principle that this is what should happen. But in practice, this is not really happening. Still, you're having the special forces lead these house searches.
Was there any evidence that Habib ar-Rahman was a member of al-Qaeda or of the Taliban? Who provides intelligence on the people who are being arrested?
Often the intelligence comes from other people in the neighborhood, and this is what makes it so complicated, because with Afghanistan has been through 30 years of war. It's a very complicated society with tribes and militiamen and warlords, and there's often a very complex set of rivalries and feuds. So people have taken advantage of those rivalries, and it would be as if I have a neighbor and I don't like my neighbor, or you know, the neighbor has a piece of land that I really want, and so I can go and tip off the U.S. authorities that, well, guess what, that guy is a member of al-Qaeda or a member of the Taliban, and that's the best intelligence often that U.S. officials have to act on. So they'll act on that and they'll take the other person away. And there's been many, many cases where locals have done this sort of thing. And in fact, the case in question, I've talked to the family members, and they suspect that it is somebody who wanted to see Habib ar-Rahman removed from the picture, and therefore talked to the U.S. authorities and accused him of being a member of al-Qaeda.
Habib ar-Rahman was a computer programmer. In your article, you talk about night raids going after a government employee, a former police officer, a physician. Is it common for these raids to target professionals?
I don't think it's common to target them more than anybody else. But I chose those cases in particular because they were more clear that these people at least had somewhat of a case that they may have been innocent. And in a number of these cases, as I mentioned in the story, they were actually released after being held for 6 or 7 months and given a letter of apology from U.S. forces. To me, that was more interesting than just looking at a typical farmer or somebody else who we may or may not know exactly where he stands.
My guest is Anand Gopal, whose article, America's Secret Afghan Prisons, is in the February 15th issue of The Nation. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later on in this show, a healthy college athlete's journey after he suffered a series of strokes and brain bleeds, and then find out what the latest research is revealing about our brain's response to fear. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from Bank Street College of Education, presenting its continuing professional studies program, offering weekend courses on topics such as bookmaking in the classroom and teaching language arts kinesthetically. More info at bankstreet.edu/CPS. The Valley Hospital for Robotic and Minimally Invasive Surgery, where surgeons use the Da Vinci system for minimally invasive procedures and can offer a broad range of complex surgeries. Info at valleyhealth.com/robotics. Roundabout Theater Company, presenting Barbara Cook, Vanessa Williams, and Tom Wopat in Sondheim on Sondheim, a musical theater event conceived and directed by James Lapine. Performances begin March 19th. Info at roundabouttheater.org.
The Jazz Loft was a dingy five-story walk-up.
It was creaky and had this real interesting odor.
But for a while, in the 50s and 60s, it was the place to make music and hang out.
I was willing to bring a bass there and climb up all those stairs and play as long as they wanted to play, you know.
This is Sarah Fishko. Join me for Hours of Stories on a Jazz Loft anthology every Monday night in February at 10 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
We're talking with Anand Gopal, whose article, America's Secret Afghan Prisons, is in the February 15th issue of The Nation. How did you find sources for investigation? Were you able to travel throughout the country to interview relatives?
Well, it was difficult at first, but I did travel quite a bit. I'm lucky because I can blend in, especially if I grow out my beard, and I'm able to speak the local languages. So I was able to move around enough to be able to meet people. So I've, for this story, I went to more than 14 different provinces. and interviewed dozens and dozens of people to be able to build a picture of what's happening.
Are former detainees open to discussing their experiences?
Most are not, and especially given that I'm an American, and given what they've been through, they're not too willing to speak to an American about their experiences. But some feel that the only way that people can know what's happening is if they tell their own stories. So there were a few cases where I had to really try to convince the person that if they told their story that nothing would happen to them, that they wouldn't be taken away again, which was another big concern by many people.
What about the U.S. military? Were they responsive to you when you asked them questions about this?
Well, you know, this is one of the things that was very difficult in doing this, is that there's so much secrecy that's shrouding this whole detention process. And often the secrecy is such to the point where even when a raid happens, it's done by special operations forces, and then the conventional military forces don't even know that the raid has happened. So a raid will happen in Village X, and I would call the military representatives in that area and ask them about the raid, and they'll say that they never heard of any such thing. When in reality it was actually, you know, the Green Berets or some other elite force that was doing it, but they're operating in a separate command structure from the regular forces.
And could you speak to the Green Berets?
No. It's very difficult to speak to any of them. They don't really have a spokesman in Afghanistan, and I sent queries to Washington, D.C., but none of them were answered.
So what happens to the people who are arrested in the night raids? Where are they taken?
Typically, the people who are arrested are taken to one amongst a series of small detention sites that are mostly on U.S. military bases. There's nine of these that we know of, and these are basically holding cells where they're interrogated. They're typically kept there for 4 or 5 days, interrogated, and then if they're deemed to be a threat to the U.S. presence, then they'll be sent on to the main prison of Bagram.
And do their families know what's happened to them?
No. From the moment they're taken from the house, the families have no clue what's happened to them. They don't even know if they're alive or dead at this point. The Red Cross, the International Red Cross, has been able to meet detainees who have reached Bagram and then been able to connect those detainees with their families. But until the detainees reach Bagram, the families have no idea, and in fact, this is one of the things that causes the most anger and frustration amongst the population, is that they're not able to track their loved ones and find out what's happened to them.
Are the detainees told what crime they're being charged with?
They're often not being told. Usually, they're interrogated for a series of days and asked about names and people that they may know who are big insurgent figures, or asked about their connections to the insurgency. But a very common complaint amongst the detainees is that they had no idea why they were detained in the first place.
Are we still hearing charges of torture, or is that something that's been discontinued?
We're still hearing charges of abuse, particularly in these small field prisons, or even more so nowadays en route to these small field prisons. And these charges run the gamut from sort of slapping, punching, and kicking to more serious charges, such as being forced to assume what interrogators call stress positions. For example, being forced to sit on your knees for extended hours, or sleep deprivation, not being allowed to sleep because there's blasting loud music, or in other cases, being stripped naked and asked to stand outside. In the early years of the war, most of this happened in all of the prisons and in the main prison of Bagram, but nowadays it's gotten much better in the main prison of Bagram, and when this is happening, it's happening more so in the process of capturing the detainees in the houses.
Now, why are they being held in these field detention sites before they're sent to Bagram? Why not just send them right to Bagram?
Well, part of it is the sheer volume of people that are being detained. Bagram can't accommodate all of those. So Bagram is set up as a sort of long-term detention site, whereas these field detention sites that are on the military bases are set up more as temporary holding sites. So they'll bring hundreds and hundreds of people in the course of a given month to these sites, but only a fraction of them they'll deem important enough to send on to Bagram.
And you mentioned that there's a large new prison that will open soon?
There's a new prison that's going to open near Bagram, and this is supposed to be everything that Bagram wasn't. It's supposed to be much more humane and much more amenities there. And in fact, the authorities went and showed journalists the new prison, even though they never showed them the old prison. But this is a sign that things, at least in the center in Bagram, are getting better, because the new prison is supposed to be better than the old one.
What is the black jail?
Second prison, a secret prison that is on the Bagram airfield. And I remember Bagram airfield is actually a big U.S. military base, of which the Bagram prison sits on. But the Black Jail is another prison on that airfield that's separate, and it's run by Special Operations Forces. And again, while in the main prison, the allegations of torture have mostly subsided in the last few years, there are still allegations that persist in the black prison. And the prison is mostly used for solitary confinement. So I've interviewed people who were taken there, kept in a windowless room for 5 or 6 days with loud blasting music. Sometimes they're abused. And then sent on to the main prison of Bagram.
And nothing has changed since the Obama administration came into office?
In regards to the black prison and in regards to the whole night raid and detention process, not much has changed. The biggest change that we have seen is that the Bagram prison, the main prison, has gotten better. But this is a change that's predated Obama. This is started under the Bush administration.
But it's something that the Obama administration has endorsed as well, or at least allowed to continue?
At least allowed to continue. And, you know, I've queried Obama administration officials, and I haven't gotten a straight answer on this. But at the very least, they've allowed everything that's happened before to continue now.
Do we know of examples of night raids turning up dangerous terrorists?
Well, certainly. Night raids do turn up insurgents and insurgent commanders, and there's been a number of cases of that happening. But what's in question is the ratio of successful captures to people that are innocent. And it seems to me, based on my research, that it turning up the actual insurgent commanders or actual insurgent leaders is in the minority, because we rarely see major figures that are captured and brought to the prison. So usually it's really low-ranking people, or it's people of questionable ties to the insurgency.
Has there been an effort to limit the civilian casualties of the night raids?
Not of the night raids. There was a big push starting this summer to limit civilian casualties caused by airstrikes. And as I mentioned before, airstrikes are much louder, in the sense that if an airstrike happens somewhere, maybe even the whole world will know about it if a lot of people are killed. These night raids are much quieter. If people are killed, it's one or two people at a time. And so it doesn't make as much of an impact. And so, but at the same time, there hasn't been a major push or change in the way the night raids have been conducted. They've been conducted mostly the same way throughout the last 8 years, and that includes the collateral damage that goes along with that.
My guest is Anand Gopal, whose article, America's Secret Afghan Prisons, is in the February 15th issue of The Nation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did you end up reporting from Kabul? Did you set out to report from a conflict zone?
You know, I was living in New York City in 2001 and very close to the Twin Towers, and I had lost friends in the attacks. So since that time, Afghanistan and Pakistan have sort of always had resonance with me, and I was always interested in following what was happening there. And I always thought that that was the place that was more interesting than Iraq, even, because of what happened on 9/11. And so at some point I decided to go out to Afghanistan and try to see for myself what's going on.
And reported for the Christian Science Monitor and the Wall Street Journal. Also have a website, anandgopal.com.
That's right, yeah. And I try to put up most of my dispatches from the region on the website.
How did you hear about the night raids?
Well, I was interested in the issue of civilian casualties, and I started looking into this just after there was one particularly major incident in which up to 100 or maybe even 150 people were killed in the western part of the country in an airstrike. And so I was interested not so much in the airstrikes as such, but what that did to the political mood on the ground amongst the locals. So I went around the country and met a lot of people and tried to gauge the sentiment. But again and again, what people wanted to talk about were not so much the airstrikes, but these night raids that are happening. I didn't know much about them. I had heard things here and there, but when I talked to a lot of people and I found out that this is much more prevalent than even the airstrikes are, then I decided to shift and actually focus on the night raids.
There has been, there used to be a lot of discussion about whether you can get a real sense of what's going on if you're embedded with a military unit. Have you ever done that? And would you have been able to come up with this story if you had been embedded with a group?
I've been embedded with the U.S. military a number of times, but I would not have been able to come up with this story if I had been, because with the night raids, usually are done by the special forces, special operations forces, who typically don't allow people to embed with them. So I've embedded with the conventional military forces, for example, the infantry. And there is a very specific perspective one gets from embedding, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad perspective, because I was able to understand a lot about how Afghanistan looks through the eyes of a soldier. And then from the perspective of a soldier, it is a very difficult place to navigate because of the very complex cultural framework and the various tribes and commanders. So it was very useful for me to embed with the U.S. military.
Sometime last year, the number of private contractors in Afghanistan surpassed the number of U.S. military personnel. Are private contractors involved in these raids?
It's unclear to me. I've interviewed people who have seen non-uniformed interrogators being involved in the detentions, but it's unclear whether those are CIA or private contractors. But if they were CIA, then it does make it likely it could also be private contractors involved, since the two work together.
And what about the Afghan Army? Are they involved?
The Afghan Army isn't typically involved in any major part of the interrogations. It's usually completely done by the special forces.
And that includes the people administering the detention facilities?
Yes, people administering the detention facilities, the people doing the night raids, people transporting them from the homes to the detention facilities are almost all special forces.
A U.S. intelligence official said late last year that the government estimates there are fewer than 100 al-Qaeda members left in Afghanistan. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
Yes, I think it's even an optimistic assessment. I think it's probably less than that, because al-Qaeda has almost no presence in the country, and it's almost a completely local Afghan insurgency, and al-Qaeda is mostly across the border in Pakistan.
So it's Taliban and other resistance groups?
That's right. There's a bunch of them, but Taliban's the main one, and these groups ideologically are different from al-Qaeda as well, because they're mostly concerned with what's happening inside Afghanistan. They have very little aspirations for global jihad the way al-Qaeda does.
Has there been any crossover into the Pakistani side of the border?
Crossover from...
from Afghanistan, because we're really talking in many cases about the same people, aren't we?
We are, but there's the Afghan insurgency's leadership is based in Pakistan, but it's a very complicated picture on the ground, because there's also Pakistani Taliban, which is separate and is mostly fighting against the Pakistani state. And they have a sort of nominal presence within Afghanistan, but in Afghanistan it's almost entirely a local insurgency.
Were you surprised by President Obama's decision to escalate the war?
I wasn't surprised, because my time spent on the ground, I got the sense from U.S. military commanders that they felt that what they had been doing before just wasn't working, and they needed to either radically escalate or to leave altogether. And those were the two choices on offer, and I didn't expect them to leave altogether, so therefore escalation wasn't that surprising.
Do most Afghans support the war effort at this point, do you think?
Well, it's important to realize that the war right now is only being fought in about half the country, in the ethnic Pashtun areas. In those areas, I think most Afghans don't support the coalition presence or the war effort. Outside of those areas where the other ethnic minority groups live, I think there's a higher degree of support of the coalition presence.
General Stanley McChrystal argued last September that the additional forces were necessary in order for the war to succeed. What would constitute success in the war at this point?
Well, your guess here is as good as mine. I've heard different things from different people. If the goal is to defeat al-Qaeda, well, al-Qaeda really doesn't have much of a presence in Afghanistan at the moment anyway. If the goal is to militarily defeat the Taliban, that's a whole different scenario, which would require a massive number of troops for many, many, many years and a major change in the Afghan government.
And was the situation made more complicated by the circumstances of Karzai's victory in the election?
Certainly, because the Karzai's victory, which was widely accused of being done by fraud, really undermined his position amongst many Afghans, and particularly in Washington, because a lot of people in Washington saw him as not a credible partner anymore.
Well, the Taliban succeeded the first time because they came into to straighten out a chaotic situation. If the United States withdrew, would the same kind of thing happen, and would the Taliban be the likely winners?
I think in the Pashtun areas, which now the Taliban is predominantly a Pashtun movement, in the Pashtun areas, I think they would take power very quickly the moment the U.S. forces left. It would be more complicated in the non-Pashtun areas, where there's other ethnic minorities that have suffered a lot under Taliban rule and would resist the Taliban, any sort of Taliban government.
That's what happened last time, wasn't it? Eventually, the Taliban had a series of military victories and took over certain areas that were resisting.
Well, that's right, and with a lot of bloodshed. I think this time around, there'll be more resistance than there was last time, just because of the experience of these minorities living under the Taliban.
Do you think that the Obama administration's timeline for withdrawal is likely to hold?
No, I don't think so. The whole timeline is predicated on the fact that on the idea that the Afghan police and army would be ready to take over the reins, but that's nowhere near the case. The police, in particular, are nowhere near ready to be able to actually take over security responsibilities by 2011.
Anand Gopal is a journalist who has been reporting out of Kabul, and his article, America's Secret Afghan Prisons, is in the February 15th issue of The Nation. You can also read his other reports on Anand Gopal, ANANDGOPAL.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.